is 4:55 on October 23rd. Okay, so, hi. Any questions? You're turning in an assignment this evening, I hope. That website is working, I think, because I saw somebody turned it in. If for some reason the website doesn't work this afternoon when you go to turn in, do please let me know and I'll fix it right away. And the due date for this one is 5 o'clock, right, rather than midnight, so that we can get these looked at over the weekend. So we're in the process of talking about Ethernet, and we had talked about having moved from a bus topology in the early days of Ethernet to typically a star topology, first using a hub, and nowadays using switches here. And we're going to talk about the difference between hubs and switches here later today. So across all of that change with Ethernet, over now close to, more than 30 years, why do we still call it Ethernet with all these changes? Well, the answer lies in the link layer wrapping that we do of the packets, of the network layer packets. It's remained the same across all of that. And it looks like this. Remember, this is what goes on the front of the stuff coming down from the network layer. The data here is really what we get from the network layer, and the CRC is a trailer that's stuck on by the Ethernet layer. So it starts with something called a preamble, and the preamble is nothing more than a sequence of alternating bits, followed by an eighth byte that ends with a 1-1 instead of a 1-0. Well, why do we do that? This is a very physical layer sort of thing. It's how the sort of computer science. This is where computer science meets computer engineering in some sense. We need time at the beginning. We need a physical representation that lets the receiver sort of get synced up in its clock with the sender so that it can tell which bits are ones and which are zeros. If you don't do that, there's a voltage there and there's a high voltage there and a low voltage there. What does it mean? You don't know. Does that mean lots of ones followed by a zero or one one? You've got to get the clocks synced up. And that's what these do when you know that there's a pattern like this coming. The frame starts like this. You sync up on the clocks and then you're ready to go. But otherwise, it's not very interesting from a computer science point of view. Then we have the Ethernet destination address and the Ethernet source address. And I should mention about this. Do I still have my Wireshark running? Yes, I do. How about that? I wanted to mention something about this because I don't think they make a very good make it very explicit in the book. The convention for Ethernet MAC addresses and other MAC addresses that use the same sort of design is that we write the MAC addresses as a sequence of 6 bytes separated by either colons or hyphens, and the bytes are written in hex. So it's instantly possible to distinguish a MAC address visually from an IP address, which is written as a sequence of bytes, the bytes individually written in decimal separated by dots. So dotted decimal notation versus colon separated hex notation. Okay? So just so you know, You see something like this, it's going to be a MAC address. I would guess that if every one of you turned over your laptops that has a laptop here, you'll find a number like that somewhere on the bottom of it, saying what the MAC address is of the Ethernet devices. Okay, so you're looking, and now you're going to call me liar, I suppose. But yes, they should have many. If it has a radio and a wired Ethernet, it should have two of those somewhere. And if you can't find it there, you can typically find it from either. You can find it through software using ifconfig. Well, let's see. Let's go back up to my. All right. Yeah. So here's the wired Ethernet address of my laptop. And I guess Ether1 is probably the wireless. No. Anyway. Okay. So MAC addresses. So those are 6 bytes each, and they come in the header. And then you find a type indicator, which is a byte, I think. Yeah, let's say a byte, which is one of these magic numbers globally known that associates this particular frame with a higher level protocol, a particular higher level protocol. So it might be there's an indicator here for IP, there's an indicator for ARP, there's an indicator for IPX, which is the Novell networking number. There's a number for the Xerox protocols. There's a number for DECnet. So there are a whole bunch of upper layer network protocols, and this is what? The demultiplexing field that's used to determine which one of those should process the contents of the frame. Okay? So demultiplex, this is why I thought it was so important to ask what is multiplexing on that first exam? Because here again we have another instance of it. We have a lower layer being used for a whole bunch of different things. When we receive something of this type, we have to choose which of the upper layers should get it. So that's another instance of multiplexing. Okay, so I guess it should be fairly apparent by now that the Ethernet setup is completely connectionless. Senders and receivers, senders send frames, receivers receive frames, and that's all that happens. Right? There's no acknowledgement. There's no negative acknowledgements. If we want to recover from missing packets, it has to be done at the upper layer. Okay? And so the protocol is unslotted to CMSC. All right. So just to step through what happens, when we're sending a datagram, we put it into a frame. It uses carrier sense multiple access with collision detection. So if the channel, if the wire is busy, the NIC will wait until it's idle, and a certain amount of time after that, actually, and then transmit it. And once it starts transmitting, it goes all the way to the end, sort of regardless of how big it is, although the maximum is 1,500 bytes. It goes all the way to the end, and then it's done. If it detects a collision, that's the CD part, during that, it stops. But as it stops, it actually sends a whole bunch of one bits just to ensure that everybody on the network sees that there was a collision. And this has to do with, remember those diagrams that we had like this. There could be nodes sort of in between here that saw a collision, but the sender didn't. If you aren't careful to make sure that you go ahead and keep sending for long enough that any collision has had time to propagate to both ends of the wires. Right? It all takes time. And so then once a collision occurs, you enter this thing called exponential backoff. And this was actually one of the innovative things of Ethernet. It said that the way we adapt to congestion on the Ethernet, which is really too much traffic for its ability to handle it, is we slow down. And the more congestion we see, the more we slow down. So this is sort of a multiplicative decrease sort of behavior of a different kind than we saw for TCP. But it is nevertheless multiplicative decrease. If we keep trying to send and we keep seeing collisions when we do, then we back off farther and farther. Okay? So doubling the time that we wait each time, but only probabilistically. Okay. So it's a different kind of exponential back off than multiplicative decrease, but it still is. So you say, the first time I'll either wait or not, the second time I'll randomly. Second time a collision occurs, I'll wait either 0, 1, 2, 3, or 3 times randomly, then up to 8, up to 16, and so forth, until you get to 1024. Well, 1023. Okay. So if a bit is 0.1 microseconds at 10 megabits per second, and we've backed off 10 times, that's 2 to the 10th, then we're going to wait about up to 50 milliseconds for that go. So I guess they have a Java applet that shows this. I haven't looked at that one. I don't know if I'd highly recommend it or not. Why don't you take a look and tell me? Does it help or does it not, understanding this? Okay. Any questions about this? Yeah.
So normally, like back in the day, you have a switch, mm-hmm. and everything is plugged into the switch, and each part of the switch is like its own separate interface, right?
Uh-huh.
So does this stuff matter for
yeah.
that?
Okay, so Chad is asking, does any of this stuff matter in a realm where every host is plugged into its own switch port? And the answer is no. This is what goes on in what is called the collision domain, which is a bunch of things that all treat what they're plugged into as a bus. Okay. Now, in a modern installation where every host is plugged into a switch, that won't occur. Okay. But even today, you sometimes see a switch with a hub attached to it and a bunch of hosts. And then everything out there is a collision domain, and this still is what happens. Like, I actually have a situation like this in my office. And you have some in your room?
Yeah, so yeah.
Pardon?
I put stuff behind the hub so I can look at packets.
Right. So actually, that's a good point. If we're going to talk more about switches a little bit later, but if you have a switch here, and you put your Wireshark in promiscuous mode, the only thing that you'll actually see here out at your sniffer is the packets that are destined for your own host or broadcast packets. And if you want to do diagnosis on something using a separate machine or what's going on in your home network or something, being able to put a hub in place is nice because then you can watch somebody else's traffic as well. So that's nice. Good point. Thanks. We're going to skip the efficiency thing. Okay, just to show sort of how Ethernet has evolved, there's a 2 megabit per second version that runs over little tiny coax and is used, you know, the place I know that it's used is inside Xerox copiers and printers. Okay, it's sort of a process control bus for running all the motors and vacuum pumps and stuff that it takes to lift a piece of paper off of a stack and run it through a machine at very high speed. 10 megabits per second was the first commercial Ethernet. 100 megabits per second has been available for upwards of 10 years now. Gigabit per second Ethernet is pretty widely available today. A lot of machines that you buy in the server class will come with a gigabit per second interface, and 10 gigs is the coming stuff. The interesting thing is that across this range, at least, 10, 100, and a gig, the interfaces can do any of those. Right? So they will negotiate electrically with the other end of the wire what speed they're going to run at and go as fast as they can. I don't know whether the 10 gig networks do that. So 10, 100, and gig all run on the twisted pair wiring. I don't know if 10 gig does. Once you get up into the higher speeds, it's popular to go on to optical fibers and do it that way instead. There was another thought I had about this. Oh, yeah. After you graduate and want to talk to your legislature, encourage them that we really should have something better than 10 megabit per second networking in the engineering quad at WSU. All the offices are wired for 10 megabit per second Ethernet, and 100 megabit, like I said, has been the standard for at least 10 going on 15 years. So, you know, if you want to be politically involved, that's something you could do. Pretty silly. Okay, this is just sort of a throwaway thingy. A physical layer description of what's going on with the voltages in something called Manchester encoding. I don't really know why this is in here. It's sort of mildly interesting. Basically, what this is a trick to ensure that there are plenty of transitions in a signal so that a receiver can again keep its clock synchronized to the sender. The problem here is that if a long time period goes by and you're sending a whole lot of zeros and all you do is send a zero value for that whole time, it may become uncertain as to whether this bit was really here or whether it was over here if your receiving clock gets out of sync over that period of time. So the Manchester encoding says that every bit time will have at least one transition in the clock. either one or two. And so all you have to do is keep the clock synchronized for essentially one bit time. And then you'll see a transition. You'll see at least one transition in the signal, which will tell you where the sender's clock is again. I don't know. It's physical layer stuff. But computer engineering meets computer science. That's how it is. Okay, so we're gonna finish up this stuff before the exam by talking about link layer switches and how that works. And then we'll stop with the new material. Okay, so like I said before, a hub is nothing more than a great big long bus shrunk down to 6 inches or so, right? And everybody plugs into that. It's really just the same as plugging into the coax, except that it's in a very small space. Okay, so everything that comes in one place goes out the other. There's a earlier technology that sort of was the progenitor of the hub idea, which was a repeater, which is simply a device that sees bits on one side and makes them go out the other side at essentially the same time. And that's what a hub does, except it does it in a starish fashion instead of just two. Okay, so it's a dumb device, and it doesn't really add anything useful to the Ethernet story, although it's handy in configuring stuff easily. So then a link layer switch is a more active, smarter device that can actually interpret what's going on in frames and decide whether it needs to go out on a particular link or not. So you get a frame coming in, you look at it, and you say, is there any reason to send this frame out on that link or that link or that link? Well, what would be the reason for sending out the packet? The destination is there. Okay? For not sending it, the destination is not there. So then in a switch, each of the separate ports is a collision domain. Whatever is out there. And if you put other switches out there, you can sort of limit the size of the collision domain. All of this was introduced into commerce without ever having to change the way that that Ethernet interfaces worked in host computers. It was sort of done transparently. And that's pretty neat. I mean, this is why Ethernet has been so successful, I think, is that sort of some initial design decisions, which surely were not made with this kind of stuff in mind, have fortuitously worked out so that you can do stuff like this. You know, I think IP has a bit of the same flavor, but IP at the internet layer really had a design that was intended to sort of weld together networks of different types. Ethernet, it feels a lot more accidental to me. And then people have worked very hard to shoehorn new technologies into, under, and around Ethernet so that this transparency is preserved across now a very long period of time. Okay, so switches, unlike routers, do not need to be configured. You just put them in place and plug things in, and it works. Well, what do they have to do in order to do that? Not quite ready for that yet. Well, it should be obvious that with a switch, we can potentially, depending on the ability of the switch to buffer and switch packets, we can potentially have two conversations or three conversations going on through that switch all at the same time with no interference. Another thing that switches do these days is they actually take the switch itself and the host plugged into it. Let's look at this. Here's the switch. Here's the host. Now, you know, if you confine yourself to just looking at that picture and what I've said before, you'd say, ah, that's a collision domain, right? And the host and the switch can't both send at the same time. But no, they've actually designed this now so that there's essentially another set of wires here so that traffic going from the host to the switch goes on one set of wires, from the switch to the host goes on another set of wires, and we actually have full duplex links here. And the host and the switch can send at the same time. So not only do we get, say, 100 megabits per second Ethernet, we get 200 megabits per second Ethernets in that configuration. Okay? Okay, so now we get to how does it work. It's sort of like a router, but it's self-learning. We have a table. Okay, so a switch has some numbered ports, say 1 through 6 here. We have a particular MAC address. And so on and so forth. All right? So how does the switch learn this table? That's essentially what's going on here. The switch has to learn the table. You power it up, and it knows nothing, and as the network runs, it actually learns the table. So, remember what the frames look like, the Ethernet frames. There's the preamble, and then there's the destination, and the source, and then the data. So every time the switch sees a frame, it sees, in particular, a source address. And knowing that it's seeing a frame that came from host A, it is able to say, ah, that came from host A and it came on link 1, therefore I should associate the MAC address of host A with link 1. Okay? So that's essentially the way it works. That's how it learns. And then we're only faced with the problem of, well, suppose we're starting up and host A says, I want to send something to host A prime, and A prime is not in the table. If A prime is in the table, we know what to do. If it's not in the table, we use the flooding algorithm that we talked about before for broadcast, right? So we go back to doing something like broadcast. This switch network still has something of the flavor of a broadcast capable network, and the switch will send the frame out on all the links except the one on which it arrived, right? And remember, we talked about that being the flooding algorithm for broadcast before, when doing it at the network level. So that's essentially it. I send out on all the links. I don't learn anything from that, right? But again, presuming that A was sending to A prime with the purpose of getting a reply, when A prime replies, then I know A's address, and now I know A prime's as well, and I don't ever have to do the flood again. This is another instance of using something called soft state. The switch may, and probably should, keep track of when it was, how long ago it was that it last saw a host, so that if the host actually moves around from port to port, and this does happen, it will forget the original location and go back to flooding after a while. And this can actually be kind of annoying if the switch manufacturer has set the time to live too high. Then you can get in situations where you move a host and it can't be found for a while, especially if it's silent. Right? If it doesn't say anything, if it doesn't itself send anything, then the switch won't learn that it's there. And neither will the switch go back to flooding because it thinks it knows where it is and it doesn't respond. Okay. I think that was... Okay. The other thing that is... you got to watch out with switches, and I don't know how prevalent this is anymore, but I certainly have had, within the last few years, problems on my home network associated with switches that... do not have the ability to record enough MAC addresses for ports. So if I put too many computers on a single port, it will not be able to cache all of them and will not sort of be able to reach them from time to time. So you got to watch out for that. And unfortunately, even at that time when that was going on, the manufacturer of those switches didn't tell you how many hosts it could support. Well, it was quite annoying, and you know, I'd have three computers plugged into the port, and you know, only two of them would work at once, and the other would suffer for long, long timeouts before it would work again. You know, really nasty stuff. So there were bugs. Either bugs or design flaws, and you know, hopefully that's not true of the 2009 models of home switches. I haven't had that problem for a while, but certainly did occur. You can hook switches together. And you know, using the algorithm that I described of if you know where it is, send it, and if you don't, flood. continues to work perfectly for that. The switch up here at the top, of course, has to have switch tables that are big enough to learn everything about everybody in the network to do that. Okay, so this is a... Did they do that? No, they didn't do that. So this would be an excellent little exercise to build the switch tables for each of these switches. I mean, it's definitely a little exercise, right? In switch one, we have a table that says... That says A, B, and C are on each of these links, and everybody else is on this link. In switch two, it's symmetric, switch three, and then switch four has multiple hosts on each of the links. Is that just utterly obvious, I think? Yes? No? Okay. I think it should be utterly obvious. Okay, you could put routers on switches as well. No surprise. I don't know what that's supposed to do. Okay. Finally, just so we're clear about the differences between switches and routers, routers, the idea of a router is a network layer concept, right? It's looking at network layer addresses and making decisions about which links to send things on based on network layer addresses. The routing tables are maintained, the forwarding tables are maintained by the routing algorithms that we talked about before, distance vector or link. What do they call it? Link. Distance vector and I want to say link status, but I know that's not right. Middle-aged brains. But what is it? You guys are supposed to know too. Okay. Well. Okay. Switches, on the other hand, are link layer devices, and this is a little misleading. Switch. We haven't talked about them as being bridges. They operate simply at the link layer. They operate on link layer addresses. You can't use a switch to go from Ethernet to ATM, say. Or anything like that. That's not a switch layer sort of operation. The routers interpret the network layer stuff, layer three. Hosts have everything. All right, so that's fine. So I'm not going to talk about PPP before the exam. We'll save that for after. But there was another thought I had. Oh, yes, I know what it was. I wanted to say something about this picture. Just as a caution, if you have switches that run this flooding algorithm and you wire them together so that you have a cycle in your network, right, you have big trouble. Okay? Because what will happen is that just following the when I get it on an interface, send it out on all the other interfaces, rule will not terminate, and the packet will just sort of keep going around and around and multiply and explode and bring your network to its complete knees. And the bad thing is that in places like conference rooms, it's very common to have two different networks, or to have multiple ports. It's very common to have multiple ports coming off of a switch, or maybe multiple switches, and somebody arrives with their little home switch, right, and wires it into one of them, and then there's a lot of wires around on the table, and pretty soon, you know, a few times a year, one of those wires, somebody thinks it needs to be plugged into this little home switch, and then the whole network just sort of melts. Okay, so on the other hand, at the enterprise level, it is useful to actually have such cycles in your switching infrastructure, so that you have some redundancy, right? If this switch here fails, then we've got a partitioned network. So maybe I'd like to have a redundant switch like that hooks into all of those other guys, so that if this one fails, I maintain connectivity of the whole thing. And that can be done by using some smarter algorithms for developing a spanning tree among the switches. So you run a spanning tree algorithm on the switches rather than the simple flooding algorithm. They figure out that, say, this one is not supposed to participate. And so he'll just be quiet. The spanning tree is soft state, so if this guy ever goes away, he no longer maintains his participation in the spanning tree, and this one will pick up that role. Okay? So this is kind of an important thing. The simple case is really dangerous, but the more complicated case is very useful, and there's defined standardized protocols for doing the spanning tree creation. Okay? Well, at that point, I think I'm just going to stop rather than launching into anything new. On Monday, Vic will be here. He will have seen your homeworks that you're turning in today, so hopefully he can have some feedback about that. You should have any questions for him that you have about the second part of Chapter 3, Chapter 4, and this first part of Chapter 5, which will all be material for the exam. The other thing I'm going to do is post a set of sample exam questions. Hopefully by the time the weekend is over, or sooner. Since I'm leaving Monday, it's going to be hard to do it after that. So I'll get that done, so you'll have some inkling of the kinds of problems that I'm likely to ask. Study the questions that were assigned, and always, you know, I don't want to assign sort of great numbers of problems, but at least read through the other review problems in the book and understand them. Some of the P problems in the book, as opposed to the R problems, are review questions, right? And the P problems are actually work something out. I don't intend to ask P-like problems that are harder than the ones that I asked you to do for the homework. That makes sense? Because there are some P problems in there that are sort of graduate level problems, and so you may read them and say, I haven't got the slightest clue how to do this. We didn't talk about it. We didn't have a problem about it. it's pretty safe to assume that that's not going to show up on the exam. Okay? But still, I'd suggest that you read through them so that you know at least what the kinds of problems are that crop up that people deal with in networking. Any other questions at this point? We're a very quiet group today.
Yeah, we had a midterm earlier.
Midterm earlier?
Yeah, like before this class.
322?
422.
422. Okay. All right. Well.
Sorry.
All right. It's Friday. It's a little dark. It's kind of a dreary day. Have a great weekend, and I'll see you a week from Monday.